Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 30th of January, these are our main stories. Russia says it's closing its border with China and imposing visa restrictions to help prevent the spread of the coronavirus, now known to have killed 170 people and infected thousands. Mali's government launches an army recruitment drive to help bolster its defences against jihadists who've been blamed for hundreds of killings. And the longest drug smuggling tunnel ever is found on the US border with Mexico. Also in this podcast, as Syrian forces continue their slow retake of rebel-held parts of Idlib, we hear from civilians.
People feel fear, feel hopeless. It's not only the bombing, it's the cold. There's cold winter. We don't think about tomorrow.
And the missing Mexican environmental activist Homero Gomez, who spent his life protecting butterflies, has been found dead. The impact of the new strain of coronavirus continues to be felt in China and beyond. Beijing is now urging farms to maintain food production after reports of price rises and shortages. Officials have ordered roads to remain open for delivery trucks transporting food to tens of millions of people under lockdown in Hubei province, the centre of the outbreak. Several major companies, including Google, Samsung and Toyota, have suspended operations in China because of the virus outbreak. And now Russia has said it's closing much of its border with China, as Sarah Rainsford reports from Moscow.
Russia's border with China runs for more than 4,000 kilometres. Its crossing points for pedestrians and traffic will now remain closed until further notice, as part of increasing measures to stop the coronavirus from spreading. From midnight tonight, all Moscow-Beijing trains will run non-stop. A decision on suspending flights to China will be taken later. Meanwhile, the foreign minister stopped issuing electronic visas to Chinese citizens and asked all Russians in China to register with the embassy there, as the decisions taken on whether or not people should be evacuated. Contact between these two neighbouring countries has increased in recent years, not just through trade, but a boom in Chinese tourism to Russia too, and in students coming to study here. There have been no cases of the virus recorded here yet, but Russia's Deputy Prime Minister has said they're likely.
We spoke to our Beijing correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, who is himself in quarantine at home since returning from Hubei province.
A lot of companies have said to their people, especially if they've been in Hubei province, don't come into work, work from home. We were there, that's the heart of this coronavirus emergency. But many companies have said, no matter which province they've been in over the Lunar New Year break, don't come into work yet. I mean, you mentioned Samsung and Toyota. We also have the likes of IKEA. Same thing, they're not reopening after the break of the Lunar New Year. And imagine how tough it is for like little restaurants and small businesses where people really often just get by all over China. Some of them will have to close as a result of this. It's like the whole country's been shut down. It's quite incredible. Have a look outside in the streets in Beijing. No one's around. There's hardly any, even any cars in the street. People are delaying returning to the big cities from their hometowns. A lot of companies are saying, good, don't come back yet. We'd rather you just stay where you are and work from home if you can.
Yeah, I mean, it's really worrying for individuals, but also for the government as a whole, isn't it? The government economist today was saying the first quarter growth could fall by 1 percentage point to 5% or lower. And that's really significant for China, isn't it?
Absolutely. But the funny thing is, you don't often get a case where a government does something that's going to have such a massive impact on the economy, like a downward pressure on it, and have most people saying, well, to tell the truth, we can understand why you're doing it. We should have done it earlier. Because imagine you don't take these measures, well, it could be even worse. China is lucky in a way because it has the ability to do things like shut down all of Hubei province, 60 million people. That's like the entire population of Italy locked down. It can do that. Other countries aren't able to pull that off. But desperate times call for desperate measures, I guess. And the World Health Organization is saying, again, they can also understand why China is taking these extreme measures.
Yeah, they're taking these extreme measures, but it is causing huge hardship. There's an online diary from one woman living alone in Wuhan. She says she's struggling to buy food with no idea when or if the shops are going to be open. So the lack of information for these people is a real problem, isn't it?
There's one story going around of a man who was put into isolation because he had the coronavirus, who had a disabled son who may well have died because, well, he did die. We think the reason is that he wasn't there to look after his son. So lots of terrible stories like that. And yet, what choice do the authorities have? They have to try and bring this under control. The number of infected is going up and up. The death toll is also increasing. They don't want to get anywhere near the 700 dead with SARS, but we're heading in that direction.
Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. And as Stephen mentioned there, the death toll is rising and now stands at 170, with more than 7,000 people infected. Scientists in laboratories around the world are now working to develop a vaccine. The BBC's global health correspondent, Tulip Mazumda, reports from the pharmaceutical company Inovio in San Diego, California.
We're in the manufacturing lab where there are a number of glass fermenters and beakers with this dark brown liquid bubbling away inside, letting off a very musty smell, I must say. It's in these beakers that the key ingredient of this possible vaccine for the new coronavirus is being made up. Joining me to tell us a little bit more about the process is the head of research and development here at Inovio, Dr. Kate Broderick. Dr. Broderick, just start by telling us a bit more about this vaccine.
So the virus was first identified on the 31st of December. Then approximately a week later, the Chinese authorities published the sequence of the virus. Immediately, we started working on designing the vaccines. And actually, within 3 hours, we'd come up with a fully designed DNA medicine against the coronavirus.
That's extremely quick, isn't it?
It's really unprecedented.
And how does this vaccine work?
Yeah, so this vaccine is based on DNA medicine technology, and although I'm sure you're all familiar with traditional vaccines, DNA medicine is a little bit different because we use genetic sequences. And in this case, we use the genetic sequence of the virus itself. We put that small piece of the virus genetic sequence into DNA. We grow it up in bacteria, and that's what you can smell here in this lab today. Then we purify the medicine from the bacteria, and we use that for testing. That'll be both preclinical and clinical testing.
I remember reporting on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and at the start of that, I mean, you know, people didn't have anything. There was no vaccine, no cure. The development of that vaccine had taken, you know, decades. We've known about this virus for a very long time. What's changed? How is it possible that you're able to come up with at least the design of a vaccine pretty much overnight?
I think what's really changed is the whole international response to viral outbreaks, and particularly the formation of CEPI.
And when you talk about CEPI, you're referring to this International Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness.
Innovation, exactly, that was formed in Davos 3 years ago, really, and its whole mission is to support the proactive generation of vaccines for outbreaks before they actually occur.
From everything you're seeing unfolding in China, and now in several other countries as well, how concerned are you about what's happening?
I am concerned as a scientist. I didn't expect the virus to spread as fast as it has. What also is particularly concerning to me is the incubation period, the time from when you're infected with the virus to the time that you start showing symptoms. Some people are estimating that that's as long as 14 days. And when you consider you could be walking around feeling perfectly well, but spreading this virus to everyone you meet, that's exceedingly concerning when you're trying to control an outbreak.
Do you think you can get this vaccine out in time to help people in this outbreak in China?
We are hoping to get this vaccine into human clinical testing by early summer, which is unprecedented in itself. And we hope that as we expand that clinical testing, we'd be able to get it to the people who really need it.
Dr. Broderick, thank you for your time. Well, no one knows how long this outbreak will go on for and whether a vaccine will be available to help people, mainly in China, in time. But scientists here and in many similar research facilities all around the world are racing to get one into communities as soon as possible.
Tulip Mazumda reporting. Mali has announced plans for a major military recruitment drive to address the growing threat from jihadist groups. 20 members of the security forces died over the weekend during an attack on an army camp. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, has the details.
The Prime Minister of Mali, Boubou Cisse, says 10,000 troops will be recruited over the next few months. That's a massive increase for an army which is thought to be around 20,000 strong at the moment. How this will be funded is not yet clear. Despite the presence of a large UN force and thousands of French troops, the Malian army is failing to protect civilians from frequent jihadist attacks and outbreaks of intercommunal violence. When the north of the country was taken over by Islamist militants in 2012, military experts were alarmed at how weak the army was. Since then, training has increased, but recent deadly attacks on the Malian army are bound to have affected the troops' morale.
Will Ross. The longest smuggling tunnel to date has been found on the Mexico-US border. It stretches 1.3 kilometres and it comes complete with a lift, rail track, drainage, air ventilation systems and high voltage electrical cables. Vanessa Buschluter is our Latin America editor for BBC Online.
This one was very elaborate. It was located 21 metres below ground, so you can imagine why they felt the need to build a lift to transport drugs down to that tunnel ground. It led from a lorry parking lot next to the airport in Tijuana across the border to warehouses in Otay Mesa, which is a neighbourhood of San Diego. And what's interesting is that the original exit had been blocked with sandbags, so clearly the people who built it felt that that exit was no longer safe and then built an offshoot. So they went to the trouble of doing that.
I mean, I've seen pictures of this online and people can do that themselves. The walls are extremely well cut. It looks as though there was some very sophisticated, probably very expensive machinery that did this. And I suppose the drug gangs can afford that because the proceeds from this drug smuggling route are huge, aren't they?
That's right. And the cartels like the Sinaloa cartel, which used to be led by Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who's now in jail in the US, who had experts, tunnel builders. One of them was José Sánchez Villalobos, who was recently extradited to the US. He was called the Lord of the Tunnels. He was the one who came up with the plans to build these tunnels in the early 2010, 2012, those years when we first saw these kind of elaborate tunnels being built. Now, this is not the longest tunnel that has ever been built. There was one that was used by actually El Chapo Guzman to escape from jail, and that one was 1.5 kilometers long. Of course, it didn't go under the border. It just led from the jail that he was in to his getaway house.
That was Vanessa Buschluter. Still to come, 185 goals and counting.
All of Canada is just thrilled just to have such a monumental record be Canadian.
We'll tell you how Canada has made football history. The Colombian government is proposing to resume aerial spraying of coca leaves as it struggles to contain record levels of cocaine production. The fumigation flights were suspended back in 2015 on health grounds, and it was hoped that a peace deal signed in 2016 between the government and the FARC, a rebel group, would reduce the amount of cocaine being produced. But as Michael Buchanan now reports from Colombia, it's merely opened the cocaine trade up to new, more ruthless criminal gangs.
If you do the math, I've earned a lot of money. But you don't even realize, because you see so much money that you spend and spend and think it's never going to finish.
I'm sitting in a dark hotel room in Apartado near Colombia's Caribbean coast, talking to a drug smuggler. Let's call him Alejandro. He's 29 and says he smuggles at least 6 tons of cocaine to Europe annually. He's made millions of dollars from doing so over the past few years. His words are spoken by a producer.
I used to work hard. I sold trousers in Medellin, I sold Nikes, I worked in shopping centers. And well, I would get paid and basically owe it all in rent. So this is the easiest life. I started in Medellin. I met this boss and my eyes were opened. In 2 days, I'm earning 2 million pesos, 5 million pesos, 10 in a week. Well, I'm better off doing this.
Smugglers like Alejandro are the linchpin of Colombia's cocaine trade, ensuring it gets from the mountains to the market. And there has never been more of it to sell. Production of the drug is at record levels in Colombia, making money for some, creating misery for many more.
You said this journey could be dangerous. Why is that? As we approach some military checkpoint.
In estas carreteras están...
In these routes, there are a lot of armed groups around.
I'm travelling to the village of Tacueo in Colombia's Cauca region with Wilmer Fiscu, a leader of the indigenous Nasa people. They've seen little benefit from the 2016 peace agreement. The territories are key smuggling routes for the burgeoning cocaine trade, and more than 50 members of the NASA were killed last year by narco traffickers.
Through 2018 and 2019, there's been fighting here in our territory. Armed groups are becoming strong again. We, indigenous communities, are against them, and so they want to exterminate us. This is not post-conflict. I think this is the resurgence of armed groups in Colombia.
I've come to Tacuayo to attend a meeting called by the government to explain to a sceptical crowd what they're doing to protect them and forward the peace deal. The reassurances they're giving are too little too late for Mesa Taquinas. Her husband, Canis Velasco, who worked as an unarmed guard for the NASA people, was murdered in front of her by narco-traffickers in October.
And it's very hard to remember it. I don't understand why. He hadn't committed any crime. Why would they do that? Some days later, they did the same to some of his colleagues. We have to tell the world that they are exterminating us.
Such grief has no impact on Alejandro, the drug smuggler.
The thing is, the majority of people they kill, it's because they were sticking their noses in and started asking more than they should. So for example, once we had to kill one of the boat drivers. But why? He was talking, he got paid for it, and then would go drinking, and when he drank, he talked. So that was something that was damaging me. So we had to take him down.
The peace deal was meant to cut cocaine production by offering farmers alternatives to growing coca. For most, though, that hasn't happened, and there is much scepticism about President Iván Duque's commitment to the agreement. But Emilio Arquila, a presidential adviser, says they are determined to implement the deal.
The peace process, it continues to be a success story. If you look at the killing rates in those territories before and after the signing of the agreement, the only conclusion possible is that all security indexes have hugely improved. Now, that doesn't mean that we do not need to do much more.
Much, much more in the view of the NASA people. For Alejandro, the smuggler, the government's efforts to cut cocaine production have had little effect, and with voracious demand for the drug from Europe, business is booming. Though personally, he can't see the appeal.
Do you take cocaine?
No. Because I know what the process involves, and the people who do are crazy. You know how it's made and the damage it does. The people who consume it, really, I don't know what they see in it.
That report by Michael Buchanan. The Syrian military, backed by Russia, is intensifying an assault against the last rebel-held province in Syria, Idlib. On Wednesday, we reported the retaking of the strategic town of Marat al-Numan. In the latest air attacks today, at least 10 people died when a hospital and bakery were hit in rebel-held villages nearby. Several million civilians are crammed into Idlib. Our correspondent Mike Thompson has been speaking to a 23-year-old English teacher, Noor Komosh, who lives with his family in the west of Idlib. He began by describing what life is like there now.
Every single day there's bombing. If a day passes without us hearing any missiles, any aircrafts, any warplanes, we're afraid they are preparing for something bigger than this.
Tell me what it's like to live under such constant, incessant bombing.
People feel fear, angry, feel hopeless, feel helpless. It's not only the bombing, it's the cold. There's cold winter. People got displaced. It's the high prices. It's the living expenses. I don't have the words to describe the situation.
How are you able to keep warm and get food for your family?
Actually, I really don't know. We live day by day, each day in the day itself. We don't think about tomorrow. It's the day we fed our families. We're able to provide heating materials, just like wood, maybe shoes, maybe clothes. We were able to buy some breads. Maybe we can cook something and maybe we can't. So we live each day by its day.
in the last few days, particularly, many thousands of people have begun fleeing north away from the front line. Have you witnessed this?
Yes, I witnessed this today. I was in the city and more than six trucks fully loaded with furniture, doors, personal stuff, tables, beds, blankets for people who really don't know where to go.
Because the Turkish border is shut to the north, isn't it? Where are people going?
They don't know. They just go. It's the trip towards the unknown, Mike.
And what about you and your family? Are you thinking of fleeing too?
Sometimes you think that, oh, we should go. And sometimes you think it will cost a lot of money. And sometimes you think, this is my homeland, where else I can go. And sometimes you think I should go. And all of that, just this whole conflict between you and yourself and the whole circumstances, you can't really get a decision until the things happen. You always have hope that something might change and you might be able to stay in your house. This last moment, either you decide to die with dignity or to live with humility.
That was Nur Komosh in Idlib. The Canadian football captain and striker, Christine Sinclair, has become the all-time top goal scorer in both men's and women's international football, scoring 185 goals. That's twice as many as Ronaldo. It's a remarkable achievement, as Janat Jalil heard from Megan Johnson, a journalist with the TSN Sports Centre in Toronto.
It's very exciting. I think all of Canada is just thrilled just to have such a monumental record be Canadian, and just the fact that, you know, Canada and soccer, not exactly synonymous. You know, we're not exactly known for our soccer prowess, even though the women's team has been a top 10 contender for quite some time. But yeah, just to now own this record, it's monumental for sure.
And tell us more about Christine Sinclair. She made her international debut at just 16 years old.
That's right. Yeah, she made her debut at 16 in 2000 and has been playing ever since, over 20 years now. And she's just phenomenal. She's not only just a world-class talent, obviously, to score 185 international goals, but she's just a world-class person as well. You speak to her and she is so unbelievably humble. She's very Canadian in that respect, I think, where she doesn't like to talk about herself or her own accolades at all. She's always someone that is team first, will give her teammates the credit always. And so in that way, Canada has just really embraced her.
Yeah, she's been very modest about this, but I think for a lot of Canadians, this is a very big deal. Looking at the situation with the top goal scorers, out of the top 10, 9 have been women. Why is it that women score more than men?
Good question. I think a lot of it comes from just the growth of the women's game. And for many years now, you just saw the distance, I guess, between the top teams like the Americans, like Canada, where in a lot of cases, they're unfortunately just a lot of lopsided scores against nations. Like even today, when Sinclair broke the record, Canada ended up beating St. Kitts and Nevis 11-0. So you get a lot more of those lopsided scores, I think, in the women's game than you do the men's game. And I think that's a huge factor to why it's Mia Hamm, it's Abby Wambach, it's Christine Sinclair that are now at the top of the international goals list.
That was Megan Johnson. Homero Gomez was a Mexican conservationist who dedicated his life to protecting butterflies, in particular the monarch butterflies, which migrate from Canada and the US every winter. He went missing 2 weeks ago after receiving death threats from criminal gangs, and his body has now been found in Michoacán, one of the country's most violent states, as we heard from Kevin Seif, the Washington Post bureau chief in Mexico.
We don't know a lot. We know that he disappeared on January 13th, and there'd been a big search for him, an investigation into what might have happened. And then earlier today in Mexico, his body was found floating in a well in the community where he was from. There are a lot of suspicions. You know, Homero had started sort of early on in life as a logger and had transitioned to sort of environmental conservation almost by accident. Mm. And in doing so, had angered a lot of people who were logging illegally in the place where this butterfly sanctuary is. So there is some suspicion that the people who might have killed him, who might have wanted him dead, were involved in illegal logging in this area. And as a conservationist, of course, he would have been a target.
And you spoke to him shortly before he disappeared. Just tell me about that conversation you had with him.
Yeah, I spoke to him about a month ago. And we spoke a lot about what he saw as the sort of great success of conservation in this part of central Mexico, where at one point the butterfly habitat, there's really no other place like it in the world. It had seemed like it was on the brink of disappearing because of illegal logging. And he spoke about the sort of great pride that he had in preserving the habitat, which therefore preserved the population of monarch butterflies. And he would spend a huge amount of his time just sort of like living with the butterflies when they arrived in central Mexico, these huge clouds of butterflies that would arrive. And he'd post videos of himself on his Twitter account in the middle of these clouds with the butterflies landing on him and on his clothes. It really had become kind of like a central part of his life. Unfortunately, when you take on a position like that in this part of Mexico, you're going to anger powerful people. You're going to, in some ways, like inevitably put your life in risk. And I think, sadly, that might have been what happened here. You know, you're taking on powerful people. The fact is, like, criminal organizations are hugely powerful across this country. There are lots of links between logging and drugs and other sorts of illicit activity. It's all linked in much of Mexico.
Tell me about his passion for what he was doing.
He created a Twitter account where he'd post videos of himself with the butterflies. And a lot of it was sort of like encouraging people to visit this part of Mexico. But if you want to get a sense of his passion for what he was doing, you really should watch these videos. They're really remarkable. Truly, the migration of butterflies is sort of bordering on magical to me. And Homero in these videos really embraced that. And you can just see it in his eyes, the way that he talks about conservation, the way that he talks about the monarch butterfly. Homero grew up in a tiny little town, which at the time was very remote, wasn't really well connected to the rest of Mexico. And it just happened to be the place, of all places in the entire world, where millions of monarch butterflies settle for the winter. Like, literally millions of monarch butterflies land on one or two or three hilltops in the middle of this remote part of Mexico. And Homero grew up with that, right? He grew up almost the same day every year, a cloud of monarch butterflies comes and lands in his backyard. And so I think when you grew up with that experience, and, you know, his grandparents told him that the butterflies carried the souls of their ancestors. So there was sort of this belief that these insects were more than just insects, right? That they played this really important role in the culture. Growing up with that, you could see how conservation feels like a natural transition. It took him a while to get there, right? I mean, he was making money the same way that a lot of his neighbors were by logging for a long time. But I think when he realized that these beautiful butterflies that he'd grown up with were in jeopardy, there was really no looking back. I think that it was something that he felt was his calling.
That was Kevin Seif speaking to Alan Kasuja. And you can see those amazing videos of Homero Gomez surrounded by all those monarch butterflies on the BBC's website. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.